I think we can get started. Erev Tov, everybody. Welcome on behalf of Torah Moshe. I'm welcoming you to our ongoing weekly rotating Parshat HaShavuot here. This week brought to you from Montreal, Quebec, Canada. Rabbi Michael Wittman, who is the rabbi of the Adith, Adat Yisrael Poleit Tzedek, Anshei Ozarov Synagogue. Now you know why they call it the Adith. And he's been there since 2001. He previously was the rabbi, as we were just alluding to, in New Haven, and served as the rabbi in the kosher kitchen at Yale. He's very involved in the community in Montreal. I will say one thing he's done very importantly is sort of updated the prenuptial agreement that was designed for the United States to make it sort of work in Canada, where obviously the legal restrictions are slightly different. And it's a pleasure to welcome him, a landslide, you know, just one province over. And in case anybody was wondering, I know I didn't announce it. I forgot to tell you the shiur today, of course, will be in French. Bakasha, Rabbi Wittman.
And very, very short.
Yeah, because I won't understand too much of it if it's in French. Okay.
All right. Good evening. First of all, thank you so much, Rabbi Jay Kelman. Rabbi Kelman and I have known each other for many years. We've worked with each other on a number of projects, important projects. And I'm so grateful and honored to be invited to be with you. Torah Motion is making an impact on the entire world in terms of learning Torah in all areas, on all levels. And it's such an honor to have an association and a connection with Torah Motion. And I'm very, very grateful to Rabbi Jay, Rabbi Kelman, for letting me be here. And I'm very grateful to all of you for giving your time to be with us this evening.
Thank you.
We experience so much of Yitzchak's life, our patriarch Isaac, in passive terms. As a child, he is bullied by his brother Yishmael, and Yishmael is sent away. He is offered as an offering at the Akedah, Akedas Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac, where he is literally bound and placed on an altar by his father Avraham. In our parsha, the parsha of Toldos, this Shabbos, Yitzchak is deceived by his wife Rivka and his son Yaakov in order not to give the bracha, the blessing, to his firstborn, Esav. And then by the end of our parsha, both sons have left him. Even the opening of our parsha supports this view of Yitzchak. The first pasuk, Ve'ele toldos Yitzchak ben Avraham, and these are the generations of Yitzchak, the son of Avraham. Avraham holid es Yitzchak. Avraham fathered Yitzchak. It's such a telling pasuk, such a curious verse. The first part, Ve'ele toldos Yitzchak, implies that the Torah is going to tell us what Yitzchak did. These are the generations that Yitzchak created. This is what he did. This is who he made. This is what he created. Yet the second half of the pasuk concludes with what happened to him. Avraham holid es Yitzchak. Avraham fathered Yitzchak. The Medrash goes even further in giving us, in a visible form, this idea of Yitzchak's passivity by telling us that Yitzchak looked identical to Avraham. They could not be told apart. Yitzchak did not even have a distinct, distinguishable appearance. Now, we might make the mistake of thinking that Yitzchak's life was primarily lived as a recipient, as an object, not as a subject. But it would be a terrible mistake to think this, as we would miss the profound impact Yitzchak's actions have on the life of his family, on the character of the Jewish people until this day, especially today, as I will try to demonstrate to you this evening. An insight into Yitzchak's true character and his unique greatness can be derived from a single passage in our parsha, often overlooked, in which Yitzchak is exclusively, though uniquely, active. And I'd like to analyze with you Perek Chavav, chapter 26 in our parsha. This passage holds the key to a full appreciation of Yitzchak's life. And I see in this passage four crucial lessons I hope to share with you. Lesson number one. The passage begins, Vayihi ra'av ba'aretz, and there was a famine in the land. Now, that's not so unusual. It happened to his father Avraham. It will happen later to his son Yaakov. But Yitzchak's response is unique. Avraham, faced with a famine at the beginning of Parshas Lech Lecha, goes to Mitzrayim, goes to Egypt, where there is food. Yaakov, later, faced with a famine, eventually goes to Mitzrayim, to Egypt, where there is food. Yitzchak stays in Israel. Now, I don't mean to imply any criticism or judgment of Avraham or Yaakov, God forbid. First of all, I would never criticize anyone for leaving Israel. Concerning Avraham traveling to Mitzrayim, to Egypt, at the beginning of the parsha of Lech Lecha, the commentators differ over whether it was the right thing for him to do or whether it was wrong for Avraham to leave. I leave that question to them. Concerning Yaakov, God commanded Yaakov to go down to Mitzrayim and promised him not to worry. And also in our parsha, it is Hashem that commands Yitzchak to stay in Israel. Nonetheless, Yitzchak's life teaches an unconditional, undying attachment to Eretz Yisrael, to the land of Israel. Yitzchak lives his entire life from birth to death exclusively in Israel. He's the only one of our patriarchs to do that. And Yitzchak is in Israel not only when things are good, not only when things are peaceful and plentiful. Yitzchak is there when times are tough, through famine, through drought. Yitzchak is there when children are crying, when hope is not visible. Yitzchak alone among our patriarchs never abandons Israel. Only Yitzchak never leaves. Clearly, Yitzchak's attachment, Yitzchak's commitment was on a different level, a level for which we must strive. And I will point the finger at myself as one who, here in Montreal, does not live up to what Yitzchak teaches us. If I am faced with that charge, I will feebly point out, I do travel to Israel as often as I can. And I did travel to Israel several times during war and pain to be with and to show support for our brothers and sisters in Israel. But I will be the first to admit it is a feeble, pale excuse for what Yitzchak teaches us in this passage. That's the first lesson and legacy Yitzchak provides for us in this single passage. Lesson number two. Vayehi ra'av ba'aretz. There was a famine in the land. Vayera elav Hashem, vayomer. God appeared to Yitzchak and said to him, Al tered b'traima. Don't go down to Egypt. Shchon ba'aretz asher amar elecha. Stay in this land where I have told you to stay. Stay in Israel. Okay, there's a famine. God says, don't leave. So how are you going to survive the famine? He digs wells for water. Now, I'm going to skip a few psukim now, and we will return to them later. But the Torah continues. Vayashav Yitzchak vayachpar es be'eros hamayim. Yitzchak digs wells for water. Asher chafru bimei Avraham Aviv. He re-digs the same wells that Avraham, his father, had dug before him. Vaisatmum plishtim acharei mos Avraham. The plishtim, the people who were living in that area, approximately the southwestern part of Israel, those people who were antagonistic to Avraham and to his family, they filled up the wells after Avraham had dug. Keep in mind, in that part of Israel, it's mostly desert. Water is life. It is a serious crime, a serious event, to fill up someone else's well so that it's unusable. But that's what the Plishtim did. Yitzchak redigs the wells by Yikra Lehen Shemos, and Yitzchak gives each of the wells a name. Kashemos Asher Kara Lehen Aviv, the same name that his father, Avram, had given to those wells. Same wells, same names. For example, we learned earlier, Be'er Sheva is the well where Avraham and Avimelech, the king of that area, the king of the Plishtim, made a covenant, an oath with each other, and Avraham called the name of the well Be'er Sheva. That's the name we have today. Be'er Sheva, that's the name of the well. So Yitzchak gave the same names to those wells. Seems like a lot of attention to details that are quite minor. I mean, the same wells or different wells, the same names or different names, what does it matter to us? But the truth is, these details are in fact a major insight into Yitzchak's life and character. There is a famine. So what does Yitzchak do? He does what his father Avraham did. First, he goes to Avimelech, the king of the Plishtim, just as Avraham did in last week's Parsha. Then Rashi tells us, Shehayadaita Loretas the Mitzrayim. Yitzchak intended to go from there further south to Egypt, where there was food. Kamosha Yarad Aviv, as his father had done in the Parsha 2 weeks before, in the Parsha of Lech Lecha. And it's at that point when God appears to Yitzchak and says, no, Yitzchak, do not go to Mitzrayim like your father did. I want you to stay here. So he doesn't just dig wells for water. He redigs the wells originally done by Avraham, and he gives them the same names Avraham gave them. Yitzchak's automatic reaction to any situation in life is to ask himself, what would my father have done? Yitzchak's actions teach us to keep the Mesorah, the teaching and the transmission of tradition from one generation to another, the transition of tradition that we receive from our parents and they receive from their parents. Yitzchak's legacy is vitally important to us today. I keep the tradition of my father. Rabbi Saul Berman once said in a lecture, you know that last names are not a Jewish thing. In fact, last names are not all that old. Only a few hundred years old. And it's not a Jewish thing to use last names. They are borrowed from a different society, a different culture. In Judaism, my name, I am called the son of my father and my mother. My name, Chaim Zalman, the son of Moshe, the son of Elkasara. My mother and my father form my identity. That's the role of parents. Mark Twain put it a little bit differently. He wrote, when I was a boy of 14, my father was so ignorant, I could hardly stand to have the old man around. But when I got to be 21, I was astonished at how much the old man had learned in 7 years. We are obsessed today with what is new, what is wow. And there's a place for that. Within our spiritual lives, there is a place for that. We need in our synagogues, in our schools, we need innovation and creativity and originality. And we also need continuity. We also need sustained effort. We also need the traditions and teachings of our parents. A couple of years ago, before Rosh Hashanah, I got a phone call from a reporter from the Montreal Gazette, our daily English newspaper here. As you know, every year before the high holidays, newspapers will write one or a couple of articles to appeal to the segments of their readership. Usually the article before Rosh Hashanah, before the high holidays, is about recipes. All right, that's fine. This time, this reporter, who I know and like very much, called me and she said to me, I'm doing a story on Rosh Hashanah. What are you doing new this year at your shul? The truth is, we were doing something new and innovative, and I told her about it, and she wrote about it. And I understand her question. She's writing for a newspaper. Makes sense. But when she asked me that question, I thought to myself, yes, what we are doing new for the first time is important, newsworthy. But it's also important that we will try to do well what we do every year. To be warm and welcoming to everyone. To engage in familiar prayers that are beautiful and meaningful and spiritual. To inspire and to uplift. Those things are not new. But they are also vitally important. And that is Yitzchak's legacy. Of course, if we are parents or grandparents, we have to find a balance as we raise our children and our grandchildren between, on the one hand, being able to give our children and grandchildren the transmission of values and lessons and traditions that we received from our parents and our grandparents. And at the same time, we have to balance that with leaving space for them to develop their own unique personality, character, approach to life, approach to Judaism, connection to God. There's a great poem by Mary Oliver. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things. To love what is mortal. To hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it. And when the time comes to let it go, to let it go. That balance is complex to achieve. Yitzchak is crucial in teaching us his truth through his actions. Lesson number three. Yitzchak's digging the wells occurs within a larger context that contains a vital lesson that is relevant to every single one of us. So let me now fill in some of the verses, some of the psukim that I skipped before. Vayigdal ha'ish vayelech haloch v'gadel ad ki gadal ma'od. Yitzchak was successful. His possessions grew. He became wealthy and exceedingly prosperous in this area around the Plishtim. Vayikanu oso Plishtim. And the people who were living there, the Plishtim, they were envious of him. They began to resent his success, his accomplishments. V'chol ha-be'eros asher chofru avdei aviv, b'mei Avraham aviv, and all of the wells which had been dug by Avraham and his servants during Avraham's lifetime, sitmum plishtim, the people there filled them up. V'imalum afar, and they filled them with dirt. It was an act of aggression, a purposeful act of aggression. Vayomer Avimelech Yitzchak, and Avimelech, the king of this area, said to Yitzchak, Lech mi'imanu, go away from us, leave. Ki atzamta mimenu ma'od, you have become exceedingly successful, and we're resentful of you. We're envious of you. You're causing trouble. You're causing strife. Go away. We don't want you here. So Yitzchak moved a distance away. Vayachperu avde Yitzchak banochal, vayimtzu sham be'er mayim chayim. Yitzchak moved a little ways away, and he dug a well. You know what he found when he dug the well? Be'er mayim chayim. He found the source of soft drinks. You may know Be'er Mayim Chayim is a brand of soft drinks that's sold in Heimish's stores. Kosher brand. Could be actually a good trivia question for your Shabbos table this week. What item in the grocery store has its name from our parsha? Be'er Mayim Chayim. Okay. Be'er Mayim Chayim, a well of life-sustaining water, Yitzchak dug. Vayarivu roi gror im roi Yitzchak. But the shepherds in that area fought with Yitzchak and his shepherds over that well. So Yitzchak moved away. Vayachperu be'er acheres. He dug a different well in a different place. Vayarivu gam aleha. But the shepherds who were there fought with him about this well also. Vayatek misham. Yitzchak left that area and went to a different area. Vayachpor be'er acheretz, and he dug still another well. Finally, this time he had moved far enough away. V'lo ravu aleha, there was no strife. There was no fighting over this well. Vayikra shma rechavos. Rechavot. Yitzchak called the name of this well Rechavot, which means wide open space, ample space. Vayomer, and he said, Ki ata hirchev Hashem lanu uparinu baretz. Now we have enough space Now there will be no fighting. We will be able to flourish in this area. Yitzchak digging wells is within the context of strife and machlokes, arguing and confrontation. Machlokes is dangerous and destructive, even if you didn't start it, and even if you're right. Our sages in the Talmud, Masechta Sanhedrin, do not only criticize one who starts a machlokas. They do not only criticize one who is wrong in a fight. They use the term to criticize one who is machazik the machlokas, one who engages in machlokas, one who participates in strife. And remember, there's a famine. Water is life. These people committed an act of aggression. They were clearly in the wrong. And Yaakov moved away. Now, this is not applicable in every single circumstance. But machlokes must be considered by us as sakonas nefashos, a threat to our lives. In some rare cases, it is necessary to do something that is a threat to life. But in all cases, everyone is harmed by machlokas. The Duke of Wellington once said, victory is only marginally better than defeat, because even the victors must bury their dead. Rabbi Shlomo Aviner points out, Yitzchak understood that. He refuses to be dragged into a fight. He puts into action his willingness to sacrifice for peace, even when he was right. It was better for Yitzchak to spend energy digging another well in a different place rather than fighting. Again, this is not applicable in every situation, but almost always, Yitzchak's actions here should be a model for our behavior. Finally, lesson number four. Permit me to share with you the insight of Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe. And that is that Yitzchak understands, and the Torah teaches us by emphasizing this in this passage, that though these actions may seem minor and unmemorable, that is not true. In fact, digging wells is very important for all of us. In fact, metaphorically, it is one of our central missions in life, especially today, to dig wells, to believe that under all the layers of dirt and dust, there is somewhere down there clean, clear, sweet water. That a person who is indifferent, even wicked, this is just the outer shell. Inside, underneath, there is a soul. There is life. There is a spark of God. And not just every person, but every situation. We need to search and dig down to find the meaning and the potential for growth within every difficulty and challenge. It may be hidden deep. It may take diligent effort to reach and uncover. But it is there. And this lesson that Yitzchak teaches us has dramatic practical consequence in Yitzchak's life, in the central narrative of our parsha told us. Why is it that Yitzchak chooses to bless Esav and not to bless Yaakov? Yes, I understand Esav is the firstborn, but isn't it clear to Yitzchak, as it is clear to his wife Rivka, that Yaakov is the one who is deserving of this blessing? Yitzchak, how does he not understand? How does he not see that Yaakov is the one who is refined, who is spiritual, who is deserving of this blessing? Yitzchak is not a fool. He knows his son Esav's character. Listen carefully, please, to the insight, the commentary of Rav Chaim ben Attar, the Orach Chaim HaKadosh. He provides an answer to this that is so relevant to us today. He explains that Yitzchak's insight was very deep. Yitzchak saw that though on the surface, Esav was abrasive, impulsive, rough, but he also saw that if you dig deep, there is goodness that can come from within. There is something that is holy that is inside, underneath that harsh exterior. The Orach Chaim writes, Yitzchak desired to bless Esav, the evildoer, because he thought blessings would transform Esav, that the evil in him would be turned into good. Yitzchak did all he could for Esav to improve, to bring about the possibility of change. Clearly, Rivka did not see it that way. And for some reason, which is very difficult for me to understand, even after all of the answers our commentators give, she felt that it was necessary to engage in this act of deception in order that Yaakov should receive the blessing. But Yitzchak, in choosing to give the bracha to Esav, applied the lesson that he learned from his actions of digging wells in order to understand his complex, difficult, firstborn son. I heard this story from Dr. David Pelkowitz. Many of you know of him. You may know him personally. He is a well-known, brilliant therapist and teacher in New York. He tells a story. Once a man came to him, a religious man, and said to him, "My son needs to be in therapy. You need to see my son. He needs help." Dr. Pelkowitz asked him, "What does he need help with?" He said, "Listen, I'm a religious man. We're a religious family. This son is 16 years old. He's been thrown out of 12 yeshivos. He doesn't listen to me. You need to see him. He needs therapy." So Dr. Pelkowitz arranges an appointment for this boy, 16 years old. They come into the appointment. They speak. At the end of the appointment, Dr. Pelkowitz calls the father back and says, "Okay, we had our first appointment. We had our first meeting. The next step is I need the whole family. We need to all be gathered together. I need you to bring not only your immediate family, but your extended family, everyone together at once. And that's going to be the next step in this process." So the whole family gathers, the extended family comes. They're all together in this room with Dr. Pelkowitz. Dr. Pelkowitz turns to the father of the 16-year-old boy and he says, "Okay, would you please share from your perspective what's going on? What are the issues? What do we have to work on here?" So the father of this boy says, listen, I have a wonderful family. Every one of my children is distinguished, is respected, is successful, is flourishing in life. This one is a Rosh HaYeshiva. This one is a Talmud Chacham. This one is a professional. Everyone is doing what they should be doing with excellence. And this one, he points to the 16-year-old son, and this one, he plays video games. He does nothing. He's smart, but he's wasting his life. That's the problem. That's why we're here. At that moment, the grandfather stands up. Part of the extended family, he was there. The grandfather was an elderly gentleman. And the grandfather says, I would like to speak. And he tells the following story. This elderly gentleman, the grandfather says, I was born in Poland. I was the black sheep of my family. Every one of my brothers was outstanding, distinguished, successful. For me, my father only had criticism. Whatever I did was wrong. I could not succeed. When I was 13 years old, I found a book, and I read this book from cover to cover. The book was Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler. And I told my father, this is what this man is going to do. This is not just a book. This is what's going to happen to us. And this 13-year-old boy says to his father, I'm telling you, you need to take all of us now. We need to run away now because this is going to happen. And the man says, my father said to me, you're crazy. You don't know what you're talking about. You're 13 years old. What do you know? You have no idea what you're talking about. And we argued about it. And finally, I left home at 13 by myself with nothing. And I came to America. And I built a life. I built a family. I built a successful business. Back in Poland, every single member of my family perished in the Holocaust. And the grandfather says, and now I look around this room at my family, all successful, all accomplished, all respected, distinguished. And I ask myself, which one of you in this room, which member of my children, my grandchildren, which one resembles me the most? This boy, and he points to this 16-year-old grandson of his. You are a replica of me. And he looks around at the other members of the family and he says to them, all you, my children, my grandchildren, if not for a boy like this, none of you would be alive today. Don't ever denigrate a boy like this. It is to a child like this one that you owe your existence. This is what Yitzchak saw in Esav. And why, according to Yitzchak, it was Esav that deserved, that needed this blessing. May we all merit to have and to be a parent who digs deeply to see the best in us, to see beneath the surface the goodness of which we are truly capable. My friends, thank you so much for the privilege of being with you this evening. I'm grateful to all of you, grateful to Torah in Motion for this opportunity. And I would be welcome and open to any questions or discussion you have.
Thank you very much. Okay, we'll open up. If anybody has any questions, you can unmute yourself. Just let you know, next week, next Thursday night, Rabbi Daniel Kropkin from Toronto, the rabbi of the Beit here in Toronto, and the president of the Rabbinical Council of America will be giving our Parsha Shiur next week. So everybody, welcome. Of course, all our Shiurim that we're having during the week, including a special Thanksgiving Shiur, which we will send out some information a little bit later, but we look forward to learning you. So if anybody has any questions they'd like to ask, please go ahead. Otherwise, I'll throw out a question. But anybody want to ask any questions? Bakasha. Okay.
What was the name of the poem by Mary Oliver?
You're asking a tough question. Hold on a second. It is part of a poem called In Blackwater Woods.
Thank you.
I'm a great fan of Mary Oliver. Amazing writer and poet.
I will ask you later what the new thing you were doing in Shul for Rosh Hashanah, but let's get to the serious part of this. Okay, you can answer that. Then we'll get to the serious part.
I'll answer that. We started a couple of years ago to have a person who is an expert in sign language to sign our parts of our service and the sermons so that those who are unable to hear would be able to appreciate parts of the High Holiday service. I'm not aware of any other Orthodox synagogue in this area that did that. And we've been doing that now for several years.
Very nice. Very nice. Okay. I see somebody wrote in the chat box that leaving Eretz Yisrael, can you connect root to Abraham and Jacob leaving? I don't know exactly what root, I guess she left. Okay. I mean, she didn't leave. She only went to Israel. She never left Israel.
Right.
Right. But,
I want to be clear, people, there are reasons to leave Israel. I would never want to be in a position to criticize or judge. I'm just pointing out that just in the biographical details, Yitzchak's connection was qualitatively different than the other Avos.
I also find it interesting that, the wells that Yitzchak dug, that his father dug, the Torah never tells us that Avram actually dug those wells. In other words, we only know that Avram dug those wells because it says that Yitzchak dug them, which is a fascinating idea.
You're right. You are correct. It does allude to it with Be'er Sheva. It says that they swore an oath near the
right.
Well.
So but even there,
he actually dug it, but they swore near the well. So,
and those other wells are for sure not mentioned. I mean, just one. So it's just very, we only know about it through Yitzchak doing it, which is even more impressive on a certain level, I would say.
Correct.
Your story that you gave about Rabbi Pelkowitz, I find it troubling that you suggest that Yitzchak was able to see value in Esav, which Rivka was not Rachel was not able to see. But do you think Jewish history would have been different if Rachel hadn't done what she did? I mean, you tried to rewrite the book a little bit.
You are correct. And I'm certain that history would have been very, very different. I just want to be clear, that insight comes from Or HaChaim HaKadosh. The Aruch Chaim, Rabbi Chaim ben Attar, is the one who suggests that there was actually goodness within Esav. And the Aruch Chaim actually goes a little bit further. I didn't really quote the entire piece. The Aruch Chaim goes even so far as to suggest that had Yitzchak given the bracha to Esav, he would have become a tzaddik. It would have been successful in turning him around. That's what the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh says. It's not for me to evaluate it. I'm just sharing with you his insight, which begs the question, number one, why did Rivka disagree? And number two, why did she have to go to use this method to get her way, you know, that's a very difficult thing. We'll leave for another time. But that's the insight that Chaim HaKadosh shares.
Yeah. She was clearly being deceitful, and it's hard to reconcile it with the image that we have of the
Abbas. I agree with you. I agree.
It's kind of an open-ended question. We don't really have an answer.
I do not have an answer.
It's interesting, if I may. So Rav Shimon Shaval Hirsch, that last point you said about the Or HaChaim, Rav Shimon Shaval Hirsch, you know, and this famous piece here, says that, I mean, he's critical of Yitzchak and Rivka. He said they wanted to give them, that they sent them to the same school. And that was a mistake. Esav needed a very different school than Yaakov. And it's a very sharp critique, actually, Shimon Shaval Hirsch, and people have criticized him for being so critical. But it's really quite a very modern educational piece that Esav could have been someone great, but the parents tried to make Esav like Yaakov. That's, you know, whatever. He also tries to explain why Rivka had to deceive, because the only way to show Yitzchak that he was deceived was to deceive him again. In other words, Rivka's point was that Yaakov was being, this is also in the same piece by Shimon Shaval Hirsch, that Yitzchak was being deceived by Esav, and Rivka presumably tried to convince him, although the Torah doesn't tell us they spoke. The Torah doesn't talk about that, but presumably she tried to knock him over the head. It didn't work. So Rivka said, okay, that didn't work. Maybe if I'm going to show Yitzchak how easy it is to trick him, maybe he'll realize Esav was tricking him. And as you said, you know, when Esav came and he realized what happened, what he realized is, oh my God, it's not just that I was like tricked now, but maybe I was like tricked my whole life. So that's how Shimon Shaval Hirsch explains it. Can agree or disagree.
And by the way, I've quoted that piece, and I've added just one last nekuda, one last point, and that is, when Yitzchak realizes, says, Gam Baruch Yeh, he ratifies the bracha, meaning it would have been understandable for a person who has had a trick played on them to be very upset. But Yitzchak accepts the Musar. He accepts from Rav Hirsch's point of view, and he says, yes, I realize that I was tricked, and the bracha should be where it goes. Okay, according to
her. Yeah, just okay. We're throwing okay. And okay. And iPad is just, that's pointing out that it's her father-in-law, of course. Yes, Boaz is criticized heavily by Chazal for leaving Israel. And the question is, why is Boaz so heavily criticized and Avram is not criticized? Or, well, the Ram, as you mentioned, there's a debate whether he is, but correct. Yeah, Boaz was very heavily criticized for leaving
Israel. Not Boaz, Elkanah, not Boaz.
No.
I'm sorry. Yeah. What am I talking? Yes. Of course not, Boaz. I'm sorry. It's been a while since I looked at Ruth. Thank you for that. Yeah. Ish mi beit Ephraim mi beit Lechem Yehuda. Yeah. Ushmael can I right. Okay. I apologize for that mistake. Thank you. Yes. Elimelech.
Elimelech, not Elkanah. Oh, my goodness.
Right. Yes. There's Avimelech and there's Elimelech. So you got Avimelech and Elimelech. That's also interesting. Right. Okay. Got to open up the Tanakh before we speak. All right. Okay. Anybody else have any comments or questions?
Yael Gott has her hand up.
Oh, I took your record now.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank you so much, Rabbi, for these points that you brought up. I think it's just beautiful how you brought light to Esav, who has been under a tidal wave of Lashon Hara for all of my life. I mean, I love the way you brought up that there's light, the light of Hashem is within everyone, regardless, and the parallel of that to the digging of the wells. And that he just kept digging, and he found this Maim Chaim in every one of them. I loved your shiur. I just loved it.
Thank you very much. And that's what we need to do. Those of us who have children, who, you know, we think maybe they're not on the path that we think they should be, we need to do everything in our power. That includes digging and includes looking inside and looking and bringing out what is good. And I think that this is a very relevant and practical application of this lesson. So thank you for your words.
May I make a comment?
Yeah, Annie Rakesha, go ahead, Annie.
I think we can't come down too hard on Rivka. She had the prophecy behind her. The prophets were often criticized for their prophecies. Remember Jeremiah and how the people hated him for his prophecies and wanted to kill him. So if Rivka had the benefit of Hashem's prophecy on her since the children were born, that the younger was the one that was to be blessed. Well, I'm extrapolating, but you know what I mean. The younger was the one who was supposed to be the blessed one. So she acted in fulfillment of the prophecy.
Yes, okay, that's a point.
I'd like to say one thing, if I may.
Go ahead, sure.
Rabbi Norman Lamb visited Beth Jacob in Los Angeles. Only time he visited it, he gave a Dvar Torah and the Parsha was Toldot. And he said, what's the reason that Rehovot succeeded and the other two wells did not succeed? And he gave a gewaltig explanation. He said that was the well he dug himself. He didn't have servants digging that for him. He dug it for himself.
Wow, that's beautiful. Can you imagine what it must be like or must have been like for Rabbi Maurice Lamb to have his brother come visit, to be able to say, oh, I can take Shabbos off and take it easy, and my brother will give the drasha, and he has such a drasha.
It wasn't that. It wasn't in Beth Jacob. It wasn't in Maurice Lamb's shul that he
did. Oh, okay.
Can I ask you, Mary Oliver, you mentioned Mary Oliver. I've written a lot of poems inspired by Mary Oliver. I'd like to send them to you if you give me your email address. What's your email
address? Please do. I'd love to see them.
What is your email address?
I'll ask Rabbi Jay to.
Yeah, you can send it to me. You can send it to me, and I'll forward it to Rabbi Whitman.
Okay. Lovely.
It'll be my pleasure.
Lovely. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Any other comments, questions? There's lots here. The stories in Bereishit are so rich and so Shivim Panim LaTorah at least in all of these stories and the nuance and complexity and that's the beauty of it and the multiple levels of interpretation and contradictory interpretations that all have meaning and truth. So, okay, if you don't have any questions, we wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. Thank you for being with us and be well, be healthy. We look forward to seeing you, of course, on Sunday morning. Rabbi Liebtag continuing his series on the Beit Sheni, the Tanakh books, the Beit Sheni period, and continuing all week. And we'll, like I said, I'll send out the details of our Thanksgiving shiur a little later. It's not even Thanksgiving here, of course. I know Montreal, Toronto, no Thanksgiving. We have Thanksgiving in October. But no, we're greatly influenced by the United States of America. And that's the way. Okay, everybody, be well. Shabbat Shalom. Nice to see you.
Thank you all. Thank you all.
Okay, thank you. Okay, bye-bye.